Well, the next chapter is about genetics, which of course has to do with DNA. And specifically, a big part of the chapter, the beginning part of the chapter, is about Mendelian genetics, which is simply an adjective named after Gregor Mendel. Do you know which one of these monks is Gregor Mendel? Have you heard of Gregor Mendel, by the way? Is he famous out in the real world?
I learned about him in veterinary medicine.
Good. He's the one holding the pea plant right here with the glasses. So he's credited now as being the father of genetics, even though he never was credited during his lifetime. The very careful work that he did was unappreciated until long after he died and discovered in the 1900s, finally. He worked in the 1800s. But he figured out a hell of a lot of stuff before anyone even knew what DNA was, let alone how it worked. He just conceptually figured it out because of how he worked. There was a little bit of luck involved, but it was mostly because of how careful and hardworking he was. Probably helped that he was a monk, because it probably gave him a lot of time to focus. Let me go to the second slide to talk about it. He worked with pea plants. That was his subject. It was a good choice because they were easy to grow and they had easy to work with experimentally. But one of the things that made him exceptional for his time was that biologists in the 1800s were not really big on, they didn't appreciate the importance of statistics. They weren't really all that experimental, really. They were observational. They were descriptive scientists, but they were not really doing all that many experiments. And experiments require replicates. To get good numbers, to get statistical meaning, you have to do the same thing over and over using many different individuals. Biologists in the 1800s were not doing that. Mendel was the exception. And if he hadn't been, then he would not have been able to figure out what he figured out at all. Because it just wouldn't come, it wouldn't emerge without big numbers. So he did things hundreds at least, if not thousands of different times, for each of what I think were seven major sets of experiments, all using pea plants. But each one was required its own plot of land with these hundreds or thousands of individuals kept separate from the other plots. So it took many, many years to do this. In fact, it takes years just to get ready to do it, because you have to make sure you've grown things long enough to know whether they are true breeding or not. So it takes a lot of patience, a lot of hard work. But the second slide shows you his basic technique for all of these seven major sets of experiments. Let's just say how a normal, complete flowered plant works. A complete flower is a flower that has both male and female parts. So stamens are male parts in flowers. They produce pollen, which contain the male gametes. Carpels are female parts. They produce the ova, or eggs. And fertilization in a plant requires the male pollen to land on the carpel and dig a tunnel and find an ovum, and that's how fertilization occurs. And that happens naturally, of course, without any human intervention, is what I mean by naturally. But when it came to experimentation, Mendel didn't leave it to chance. He wanted to make sure he knew what plants were fertilizing what other plants, what males were fertilizing what females. And he didn't want them to be able to fertilize themselves, because a plant with both male and female parts can actually fertilize itself, right? So to do this, he would cut off the stamens, cut off the male parts carefully without letting the pollen spill, and just leave the carpel. That would be the female subject. But he would then brush from other plants pollen from the male stamens, and then transfer with that brush that pollen to a female. And so, in other words, he was in charge of saying which parent mated with, not mated, but we use the word by analogy, reproduced with, is crossed with, what female parent. So that's all you really have to do. It's a lot of waiting and taking careful notes, because once you do that, then you have to wait for that flower to turn into the fruit. That's what flowers develop into if there's successful fertilization. And the fruit is what contains the seeds. The seeds are the offspring, right? Well, the seeds don't tell you what the plant looks like. So even once that occurs, then you have to plant those seeds, which are the peas, and then wait until the next season for them to become plants so that you can see what characteristics those plants have. And you do this over and over, hundreds and thousands of times. I need to get some definitions out of the way for us to be able to understand this chapter. In everyday life, just colloquially, rather than in science, we tend to use the two words characteristic and trait interchangeably, which is fine if you're just not talking about genetics. But in genetics, they actually have distinct meanings, so they're not interchangeable. It's best to just give you some examples to make you understand that, I think. A characteristic is just about anything that describes something about an organism. And we, you know, we're so highly visual organisms that we tend to think about how things look. That's easy to understand. It could be like the flower color is a characteristic. But also, it doesn't have to be something that you can see. It can be the speed at which an enzyme works. That's another characteristic. All right? Eye color, though, just like flower color, that's an easy-to-understand characteristic because we're used to talking about it. A trait, on the other hand, is a specific value for that characteristic. So we know, using eye color, for instance, that not all people have the same eyes colors. Eye color is the characteristic, but brown is one trait of that characteristic. Hazel is another trait of that same characteristic, and so on. So you see how they're different? Okay. In this case, we're looking at... I mean slide 3. We're looking at flower color as the characteristic. When I mentioned before that Mendel had 7 major sets of experiments, he performed them all exactly the same way, meaning with the scissors and brush technique. But what made the 7 experiments different from each other is that in each one, he paid attention to a different characteristic. And also, importantly, he paid attention only to that characteristic. So in the batch of plants in which flower color was his variable that he was interested in, that's the only thing he paid attention to and took notes about. Other features of those particular plants he did not note, only the flower color. But in a separate batch, which was a different experiment, it was a different characteristic other than flower color that he paid attention to. All right. Now, part of the luck that was also fortunate in this situation is that for each of his 7 experiments, there were only 2 possible traits. So in pea plants, the flowers can be either white or purple. There weren't any other colors in that population. And that's important, because if there are more, then it becomes mathematically a hell of a lot more confusing. And even with his big numbers and his careful techniques, he still wouldn't have been able to figure it out. So it's not only, it's kind of the luckiness of this is that for all seven of his experiments, there were only two traits for each of the characteristics. All right, now that doesn't have to be the case, but we'll talk about that in the second half of the chapter. But this is the experiment in which he cared about flower color as the characteristic. And there were two traits, which are purple and white. Now, part of the preparatory work that I said he takes years in itself is that he had to make sure that the purple-flowered plants he was working with were so-called true breeding purple-flowered plants, meaning that every season they only produced purple flowers. And similarly, the white-flowered ones had to be true breeding white-flowered ones. So that's all work that is before the experiment even begins. Once you're convinced that you have true breeding purple-flowered individuals and true breeding white-flowered individuals, then you can perform a cross. And that involves two different parents, of course. And that's why we call that cross the P generation, meaning parental generation. Okay? When he did this, he crossed purple-flowered true breeders with white-flowered true breeders, then that produced offspring after he went through the process of collecting the peas and paying attention, writing down which parents they came from and planting them and allowing them to come up the next year. Those offspring produced, once they were adults, the next generation, the F1 generation. F here stands for filial, which means having to do with offspring. In case you wondered what the F was standing for, that's the first filial generation, or the F1 generation. The children, in our terms. What he noticed when he did this for flower color is that every one of them, hundreds of them, had purple flowers. No white ones at all. Not only that, which is interesting in itself, the purple of the F1 generation, that purple was just as purple as the purple of the purple parent. So they weren't just purple-flowered individuals in the F1, they were fully purple-flowered individuals, which is counterintuitive. You know, Mendel came along in the 1800s, but for thousands of years already, humans had noticed that when organisms reproduce, their offspring are kind of, they resemble both parents, but they're kind of like a mixture of the two, right? So it's reasonable to expect that when you cross a purple-flowered individual with a white-flowered individual, you're going to get a purplish-white-flowered individual. In other words, not as purple as the purple parent. These were every bit as purple. Okay? Which is something that before Mendel couldn't be explained. Mendel had to explain that. He didn't stop there, though, which is good, because if he'd stopped there, he wouldn't have been able to figure nearly as much out either. So he did it for another season. What he did was then cross F1s with them, not with the same individual, but with other F1s of that same population. In other words, brothers and sisters were mated to produce, in our terms, the grandchildren, or the F2 generation. And when he did that for flower color, he noticed a reemergence of white-flowered individuals. It disappeared in the F1 generation and then reappeared in the F2. And this is why that trait that seems to disappear and then reappear is called, what kind of trait? Does anyone know?
Recessive.
Which is, recessive is the adjective of recede, which means to hide, right? To crawl in and hide. It's still there. It's just receding. And then it comes back out in the next generation. Recessive trait as opposed to what other kind of trait? Dominant trait. The dominant trait gets its name because it seems to dominate over the recessive trait, right? In this case, purple is the dominant trait. But in general, the dominant trait is simply the trait for which all that's required is one allele to express it. Now, I haven't defined allele yet, but some of you might already know the word. We'll get to that in a minute. Another thing, though, another important thing about these data is that he not only got purple and white flowered individuals in the F2, and the purple were just as purple once again, but thanks to the fact that he did it hundreds of times and not just with one or two plants, he noticed that there was an almost exactly 3-to-1 ratio of purple flowered individuals to white flowered individuals. That's the famous 3-to-1 ratio that we get in Mendelian crosses like this. Now, speaking of crosses, this is an example of what we call a monohybrid cross. Now, a hybrid is a mixture, right? So a hybrid cross is a cross or a reproduction between two parents that differ in traits for a given characteristic. What makes this specifically a monohybrid cross is that the mono, meaning one, is that only one characteristic is being studied here. And you don't care at all what's happening with the leaves or any other characteristic. Just flower color. So it's one characteristic, and the two parents originally are different in their traits for that characteristic. That's what specifically makes it a monohybrid cross. And if you do a monohybrid cross for characteristics that operate in a Mendelian fashion, which not all do, then you're going to get a 3-to-1 ratio in the F2 generation. And also you're always going to get 100% of the F1 generation being the dominant trait. In fact, that's how you know that it's the dominant trait, by looking at the trait that the F1s have. Okay? Or measuring it somehow. It does not necessarily look at it. Slide 4 shows you these 7 major experiments I was talking about, and you can see how many hundreds, or in some cases thousands of times he replicated the experiment. The first one we just looked at is the flower color, but each of these rows has a different characteristic. For instance, where the flower is, the color of the seed, the texture of the seed, and so on. He didn't care about anything else other than that one thing in each batch. And notice that when you look at his real numbers, which these ones in this column are, that they all simplify to almost exactly 3-to-1. And if you did it with just a tiny number, you could get totally different numbers, right? Just like, you know, flipping a coin. If it's a fair coin, truly fair coin, then there's an exactly 0.5 chance of having a heads, right? 0.5 chance of having a tail. Well, if you flip it only 3 times, you could get lucky and get 3 heads and no tails, right? Which would say, oh, it's 100% chance that you're going to get heads, and it's a 0% chance that you're going to get tails. Well, that's the problem with having a low number of replicates. If you had time to flip it 1,000,000 times, though, then it's going to be damn close to 500,000 tails and 500,000 heads, because you've done it so many times. Okay, let's look at 5, so I can define what I mentioned earlier on an allele. The two blue things here, these sausage-shaped things, are chromosomes. You actually should know that already, because, like I said, we just got through the chapters that actually come after this in the book. This would normally have been your first look at a chromosome, but why are there two chromosomes here?
from both different parents?
Yes. In other words, these are one type of chromosome of the N that this species has. But all we care about is this one type of chromosome, and it's a diploid cell this is from, which is why there are two of them, right? Any given chromosome has many different genes on it. Keep in mind what a chromosome is. The DNA is, never mind the histones, which are protein. The DNA part of the chromosome is one enormously long double helix, right? Millions of nucleotides long, but all one long sequence. If you wrote A's, T's, C's, and G's over and over. That's the chromosome. A gene is also a sequence of nucleotides, so it's A's, T's, C's, and G's in some order, but it's just a tiny bit of that overall long sequence, right? And remember also I told you that the vast majority of your nucleotides are actually not genes. They're just the sequences between the genes. The genes are spaced out. But when you have millions of nucleotides and it's still almost none of it is genes, it's almost all between genes, you still have enough room for thousands of different genes on each chromosome. And assuming these are all protein-coding genes, not all of them are, but the vast majority of them are, remember what that means is that they code indirectly for how to build a protein. So they're transcribed, and then the messenger RNA gets translated into a protein. Those proteins, remember, are what give the organism its traits. So, what we call a gene corresponds to a protein family. And what that means is that a gene corresponds to a characteristic. But just like there are different traits for any characteristic, there are different possible versions of a gene. That explains why there are different versions of proteins doing the same function but differently, right? Which is why you can have different colored eyes or whatever, because of different proteins made by the same kind of gene. So those different various variations of genes are called alleles. Okay? Now, a moment ago I said that a gene corresponds to a characteristic. An allele corresponds to a trait. So the specific trait that you exhibit for a given characteristic depends on the specific version of the gene or the allele that you have. That's why alleles correspond to traits. Genes correspond to characteristics. And a chromosome contains many, many different kinds of genes. Therefore, the overall chromosome is controlling many unrelated characteristics. All right? That's what makes it that type of chromosome. When we were talking about ploidy and N, I keep saying different kinds of chromosomes. A different kind of chromosome, these are the same type. A different type, let's say this is the number one, the number twos have a totally different set of genes controlling a totally different set of characteristics. That's why they're different kinds of chromosomes, okay? But the two homologs of a homologous pair, which is what we're looking at here, have the same set of genes because they control the same set of characteristics. That does not mean, though, that the gene versions they have, the alleles, are the same on the two chromosomes. These came from different parents originally, right? This one came from a sperm, this one from an egg, we'll say, originally, to form the zygote that became the multicellular organism that this was taken from. Well, in this case, we're looking at the gene family, or the gene, I should say, that codes for the characteristic of flower color. Same one we keep looking at. What makes the gene, that gene, of course, is where its promoter is, right? That's the beginning of the gene, and then we'll have an end that the cell recognizes. It's just A's, T's, and G's to us, but there is a beginning and ending to each gene. and it resides or it sits at a specific place on the overall chromosome. And that position that any given gene occupies is called its locus, the plural of which is loci. All right, so each gene has its own locus. In a diploid cell, which this is from, that means there are two of each chromosome. So this, the characteristic that we care about is flower color, therefore we don't care about all the rest of the chromosomes, only the one that has the locus for the flower color gene. Since it's a diploid cell, though, that means there are two loci, one on each of the two homologs. And where that locus is means that's the version of the gene you have. Well, in this case, they are not identical sequences at the two corresponding loci. One of them has the purple allele, and the other one has the white allele. So this brings up some more definitions that some of you might already be familiar with. If we're talking about diploid organisms, well, let me just start this over. What we're studying right now, like I said, is Mendelian genetics as opposed to non-Mendelian genetics. Both of them are real. Both of them occur within one organism. But Mendelian genetics is a special circumstance, and that's part of the luck I was talking about that allowed Mendel to figure things out. But if we're talking about Mendelian genetics, there has to be a couple things true. One of those is that for whatever characteristic, and by the way, you usually pay attention to just one characteristic at a time and forget about what's happening for all the other characteristics. But let's just focus on one characteristic. If it's a Mendelian characteristic, or if it's governed by Mendelian genetics, then one thing that has to be true is that there are exactly two alleles for that, or two traits for that characteristic. Not one, not three, not any other number. Two exactly. The other one, another requirement, is that one of those two traits has to be completely dominant over the other one. So there's a so-called dominant trait and a so-called recessive trait. Now, molecularly, what this corresponds to in Mendelian terms is that for the gene that you're interested in, which corresponds to the characteristic that you're interested in, there are exactly two alleles possible in the population, not in the individual, in the whole population of individuals living together. In this case, there's a purple version of the flower color gene, and there's a white version. No individual has any other version, so that's the only two in the entire population. All right, has to be true for Mendelian genetics to apply. And one of them is totally dominant over the other. In this case, purple is dominant over white. We'll look at exceptions to that, which is what makes it non-Mendelian genetics, after we get through the Mendelian part. But back to these definitions. Trait, which is a description of an individual for whatever characteristic we're talking about, is basically the same as the word phenotype. But there's a related word that you shouldn't confuse, even though they end the same, called genotype. And I just very cursorily mentioned this in the last lab. Now we'll get a formal definition of the two. Like I said, phenotype is really just a description of the trait. So it is some phrase or word, or well, the word itself is a phrase, like white flowered, that is a phenotype. Purple flowered is a phenotype. Fast running, if you know, whatever. Verbal description. Genotype, on the other hand, is just a symbolic representation of the actual set of alleles that the individual has in its cells. And once again, all we care about is that one gene that we're focusing on, not the other thousands of genes that are in that same organism. Right? So, I think you have a grasp of these, right? You notice the difference. To give you an example, though, of genotypes, I said they're symbolic representations. We usually use letters to represent alleles. There's, unfortunately, not just one standard, so it doesn't really make sense to say, well, I guess it is, there can be more than one standard, but it's not a uniform standard. Anyway, the first standard that to be used is that we use an initial for a genotype, an initial that stands for the dominant trait or the dominant allele. In this case, P would be appropriate because purple is dominant. So we use the P, though, in all cases, even for the white allele, we use a P. P just reminds us that whatever the allele is, purple is the dominant version. Okay? To actually denote which specific allele we're talking about, instead of the actual letter, we use whether it's uppercase or lowercase. Uppercase we use for dominant alleles, lowercase for recessive alleles. In a diploid cell, then there needs to be two of those letters, right? Because a diploid organism has two alleles of whatever characteristic you're talking about, whatever gene you're talking about. So in this case, the genotype would be uppercase P, lowercase p. Because this individual has one dominant allele, that's the uppercase P, and one recessive or white allele, that's the lowercase p. So this brings up the three possible categories of individuals. Now, earlier when I first used the word dominant, I said that the dominant trait is the one for which just one allele is sufficient to give that dominant trait. Meaning that a flower is going to be purple flowered, in this case, a flower is going to be purple if there is one uppercase P, at least. One is enough, though. That's what I meant by sufficient. Okay? That means that the only way you can have a white flower is for both of your alleles to be lowercase p. Well, if you think, you know, and this is the Mendelian case, so there's no other allele. There's only purple and white alleles, uppercase p, lowercase p, in the entire population. That means for any given diploid individual, there are exactly three possible genotypes, right? If you have two P's, the only possibility are that they're both uppercase. One's uppercase and one's low, or two lowercases, or one uppercase and one lowercase, right? These are lowercase, by the way. So those are the only three possibilities for any given individual. Now, these first two share the fact that each individual has two of the same kind of allele. Two uppercase and two lowercase. So that's why these are both called homozygous individuals. Homo meaning same. But obviously, an uppercase, an upper P and a lower P are not the same, right? So it's not enough to just call them homozygous. You can't tell them apart then. That's why we don't use the word homozygous by itself. Instead, we have to qualify it with a word after that. So if it's an upper-upper, then it's homozygous dominant. If it's lower-lower, it's homozygous recessive. When you have the situation where there's one dominant and one recessive, which is what's pictured here in the slide, then that's not homozygous because it's different, not the same. Hetero means different. So that's a heterozygous individual. And even though technically there's two ways that that can occur, because you could, this individual could have gotten the purple from its father and the white from its mother, or it could have gotten white from father and purple from mother. We don't distinguish between those, though, because it doesn't really matter genetically. So that means the word heterozygous is enough by itself. There's only one way to be heterozygous. That's to have one dominant and one recessive allele. So we don't use the phrase heterozygous dominant, for instance. It's redundant. By the way, we certainly don't use the word heterozygous recessive, because that's not possible in the Mendelian case, right? Every heterozygous individual, by virtue of the complete dominance of one of those alleles over the other, is going to have the dominant trait, because it takes only one of the dominant alleles to fully give you that trait. Okay? So all heterozygous individuals are going to have the dominant trait. That's why we don't bother to say heterozygous dominant. Okay, so those are genotypes. And the fact that each of these is two symbols long tells you that these are genotypes of diploids, diploid individuals, or diploid cells. Okay? That's why you have to have two for a diploid. Now, when this individual makes eggs or sperm by meiosis, the cell, the gametes that result, will be haploid. So those genotypes for those gametes will have just one P in them, either an uppercase or a lowercase. So keep that in mind too. All right, let's go to 6 and talk about a Punnett square. Punnett is a dead Englishman that we name the shorthand device after, because he started it. You might have worked with Punnett squares before, but Punnett squares are really just a shorthand device. Just an easy way of listing some things. But, and you can see a Punnett square on the bottom here. A Punnett square, though, represents something that's real. The Punnett square represents an actual biological process. What is that process? Mutation, did you say? No, not mutation at all, actually. Because mutation, which does happen, would actually confuse this. Here, if mutation happens, it has already happened. No. Not fermentation. Fermentation is the alternative to cellular respiration, right?
Oh, no, fertilization.
Fertilization, yes. Yeah, fertilization, remember, is the hallmark of sex. It's the defining process of sex. And what is fertilization? Other than the defining process of sex, what actually... Yeah, it's the union of unicellular gametes fusing together to produce a unicellular zygote. And remember, that of course is going to double the ploidy, because each gamete has its has a set of chromosomes. Therefore, the zygote is going to have two of each chromosome. Okay, now that's what a Punnett square represents. Fertilization event between two specific parents. The parents are defined in the cross. So we can also use shorthand notation to define the cross itself, the two parents. We're back to the same example here. Purple-flowered and white-flowered individuals, each of which is true breeding. Now, what's another name for true breeding that you recently learned? Homozygous means true breeding. That makes sense now in terms of alleles, right? If you're homozygous, when it comes time to making your gametes, and meiosis randomly chooses one of those two alleles you have, doesn't matter which one it chooses, because you're homozygous, right? So you're, if all we care about is this flower color gene, then that means a homozygous individual is able to make only one kind of gamete. If it's a homozygous dominant individual, the sperm or the egg is going to be an uppercase P sperm or egg, a dominant gamete. The homozygous recessive can only make a recessive type gamete. You see what I'm saying there? Therefore, they're true breeding. You know what their gametes are going to be. A heterozygous individual, on the other hand, can produce either of two different kinds of gametes. Here, though, we're starting with true breeders. So look at the genotypes. We wouldn't even have to have purple flower and white flower labels here. These genotypes should tell you the story. Upper P obviously is going to be a purple flowered individual, right? Because it only takes one uppercase P to be purple flowered. But the fact that they're both uppercase means true breeding. So this is the genotype for a homozygous dominant individual. Lower P is the genotype for a homozygous recessive individual, which is the only way you can be white flowered, right? Because of recessivity. Okay, when that's the P generation. When you actually mate those, or when you cross those, I mean, that requires the eggs and the sperm. But what produces the eggs and sperm? What process? What process produces gametes in plants? Well, we just spent a chapter on it. Meiosis, right? So meiosis randomly chooses one of the two alleles, right? That's going to go to its own cell, and then the other one's going to randomly go to the other cell, right? But this is what I was saying a bit ago. When meiosis chooses to make an egg from this parent, let's say, it doesn't matter which one it chooses. It's going to be an uppercase P. This one's, say it's the male, going to be only a lowercase P sperm. It's the only possible kind, right? Because they're homozygous. That means every individual is going to be uppercase, lowercase, because they got an uppercase from the true breeding purple flowered parent, and they got a lowercase from the true breeding white flowered individual. 100% of the offspring are going to be heterozygous, in other words, upper lower. And this tells you, because of the rules of dominance, why Mendel noticed that every one of the F1s were like the dominant parent. Now, they're not alike in genotype, right? These offspring in the F1 are heterozygous individuals. The purple-flowered parent is a homozygous dominant individual. So genetically, they're different, but phenotypically, they are not different. They're the same. And that's because of complete dominance of the one allele over the other. One is enough, and it's just as, it gives you the trait fully, just as fully as a homozygous dominant individual has it. Okay, now back to the Punnett square. I said that the square itself really just represents fertilization between these two parents. Any given cross can be represented by one parent's genotype, cross, or X, the other parent's genotype. So this one would be listed as upper P by lower P. And that's the cross itself. Well, like I said, to actually cross them requires gamete formation, which requires meiosis. That produces the gametes, though, right? And that reduces the ploidy, as meiosis does. So each gamete that these parents can make is by itself haploid. Notice that on the top of the square and to the one side of the Punnett square are listings of P's that are just by themselves. Those are haploid genotypes. And they represent the gametes that these two individual parents are able to make. So these are exhaustive listings. Now, when I was saying before that there are a practically infinite number of sperm and egg that can be produced, that's true when you consider all the characteristics. But when all you care about is this one gene, and there's only two alleles in the entire population, then these parents can produce, in this case, only one kind in the parental generation, right? But in any case, this is an exhaustive listing because you put every type of sperm that the one parent can make on top and every type of egg represented by its haploid genotype to the side. Then it's a matter of just matching rows up with columns to produce what's inside the boxes of the Punnett square. What real things are represented by the boxes of the Punnett square? The overall square represents the process of fertilization. What's inside the boxes represent real things. What are they? What are they? No. You can tell traits from them, but real material things. What are produced by the process that the box operate represents? What the box represents? What did I say? What?
Combination.
No. What did I just say? Not what's written on the page. Yes. That's right. The Punnett square represents fertilization. What's inside the boxes represent the products of fertilization, which is what? No? I mean, there's an associated genotype, but I'm talking about an object, not a concept. A real thing. A real thing made of atoms. Offspring start out as what? What does fertilization directly produce? Zygotes, yes. That's what the boxes within the Punnett square represent. The particular zygotes that these two specific parents are able to produce when all you care about is this one particular characteristic. All right, and that's because you've exhaustively listed every one of their possible gametes for this characteristic, right? And therefore, when you get together all possible combinations of those gametes to make these squares, I mean, to make the boxes in the square, you've listed every possible zygote that these two parents can produce, right? And there's no Punnett square shown for the F1 generation here because it's trivial. The F1 generation, there's only one possibility, right? You could do it as a Punnett square, but it would have just one box in it. Because one parent can produce uppercase P, the other one can produce lowercase p, and the only possibility is upper-lower. So this box does not mean that these two parents are going to have one offspring. It means that however many offspring they have, one out of one, or 100% of them, will be heterozygous. When you then get these two together, that would be a cross that's upper-lower by upper-lower. Now meiosis can choose either the upper or the lower in each parent. So that's why when they get their gametes together, there's two kinds of gametes for each parent. And therefore, four overall possibilities. That's why it's a bigger Punnett square. And similarly, this does not mean these are going to have four offspring, right? It means whatever that number is, you would expect one out of four of them, or 25%, to be upper-upper P, homozygous dominant. One out of four to be lower-lower P, or homozygous recessive. And two out of four, or 50%, to be heterozygous. And this is another famous Mendelian ratio. The genotypic ratio, the ratio of genotypes, is 1 to 2 to 1. But the phenotypic ratio that we already talked about, because of complete dominance, is 3 to 1. This is why Mendel, in all of his 7 experiments, saw almost exactly 3/4 of however many offspring there were be the dominant type, and 1/4 of them being the recessive type. All right, went a little over, sorry.